Hi, it's Diane. On my mind, a long week of counting votes. It's Friday afternoon, and while we're still waiting for a few states to announce their final totals, Joe Biden appears on the verge of winning the presidency. Meanwhile, President Trump says he has no plans to concede and continues to make baseless claims of voter fraud. I asked Susan Page, USA Today Washington bureau chief, to bring us up to speed on the count and what we might expect in the days ahead. Susan, as you and I are talking at 2 o'clock on Friday afternoon, we've just heard we expect to hear Vice President Biden speak tonight, though all the necessary votes are not in yet to make the declaration that he is the president-elect. What do you expect?
I think that Vice President Biden will change his title tonight. I think he'll become President-elect Joe Biden. I think that's the plan for his announcement tonight. And by that point, I think races in Pennsylvania and Georgia will have been called by news organizations, giving him more than the 270 electoral votes he would need to be elected our new president.
And what about Arizona? It's been in such a state of flux with both Fox and the AP calling it for Biden on Tuesday night.
Let's first note that if Joe Biden carries Pennsylvania, he doesn't need Arizona. He'll be over 270 without it. But Arizona's been a surprise because, as you noted, Fox and the AP called it Tuesday night. Other news organizations have not called Arizona. Biden still has a lead there that's getting narrower, but I think that most analysts think Biden will hold on to Arizona. But some of the news organizations don't yet feel secure enough about that to actually call the states. You know, when you get right to this point where your call is going to make the candidate go over 270 electoral votes, I think news organizations get a little bit cautious because they certainly do not want to be wrong.
Susan, how and why did the prognosticators, the pollsters, get it so wrong?
So wrong for the second election in a row.
Exactly.
We had lots of polls in the most important states, and many of them were just wrong. And I think that we need to figure out what's going on here because we rely on these polls to tell us what people are thinking, what direction things are going. 2016 was a surprising election night, and so was 2020, especially when it came to Senate and House races. So one of the things that I think may be going on, I know that you know Bill McInturff, often a guest on your show, respected Republican pollster. He did two polls of voters on Tuesday, so of voters on Election Day. And he found that 1 in 5 Trump voters said they tried not to let their friends, family, and coworkers know who they were going to vote for.
So the so-called shy Trump voters.
1 out of 5. And if they're not telling their friends and family members, what are the odds they're telling a pollster the truth about their vote? So I think that is one factor, but there may be other factors as well. And I think we really need to figure this out.
It's as though there needs to be a different approach, a different mathematical calculation altogether.
Yes, a commitment to make sure that you have a sense of who's going to vote so that you know what the electorate is going to look like. That's really important. And also maybe we need to rethink how we use the polls. Polls can be very valuable in identifying the subjects, the topics, the concerns that people care about most, but maybe we should use it less to determine and to predict what's going to happen in an election.
Susan, let's talk about President Trump. He has engaged a great many poll watchers first. And apparently, because he's not satisfied with how closely they were able to watch certain election processes, he has decided to bring a number of lawsuits, not only for that reason, but for others. So far, I gather no judge has taken on these lawsuits. Is that correct?
So far, the Trump campaign, I believe, has not succeeded in getting any count stopped. Are any ballots thrown out despite the president's allegations of election fraud? Independent legal scholars are telling news organizations, including USA Today, that so far they don't see any charge of wrongdoing or malfeasance that has evidence behind it that would prompt a court to weigh in on the counting of votes or the determination of ballots in the election. That's up to state election officials. That hasn't changed. What these lawsuits have done, though, is they've created some delays, some concern. They've created something of a cloud for at least some voters over the vote count that is going on. And that's of real concern, because in a democracy, you know, we want the most vigorous possible election. And when it's over, we want Americans to recognize the winner as the legitimately elected winner, as the legitimately elected president. And if faith in that erodes, that is a really dangerous development in a democracy.
So what he is doing is creating doubt about the legitimacy of the vote as a whole?
Yes. I think for some of his supporters, when President Trump says it was rigged, the election was stolen, they counted illegal ballots, even without evidence of that, and even if the courts don't agree with him, for some voters, it raises questions. And, you know, our politics is toxic enough without having a new president take over at a time of great national crises and have some share of the electorate not believe he deserves to be there.
What is your view as to why Joe Biden managed to pull this out?
You and I have talked about this before. I've covered all three of Biden's presidential bids. The first two didn't last too long. He was not a great candidate. And some people thought he wasn't a great candidate this time, that he didn't have the vigor, that he didn't wasn't so interesting, that at the time the Democratic Party had all this progressive energy, that wasn't something he reflected. I think in some ways he turned out to be the perfect candidate for the moment. He turned out to be the kind of anti-Trump. For voters who are exhausted by President Trump and distressed by some of his really harsh and racist rhetoric, the idea that we had this calm, genial, well-liked, kind, empathetic man as the counterpart was kind of a relief. And as somebody who is more centrist than most of his competitors for the Democratic nomination, he managed to rebuild the blue wall. You know, that was how Hillary Clinton got defeated last time in 2016. She lost Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, and Michigan. And those traditionally Democratic states went to by narrow margins to Donald Trump. Well, it looks like Joe Biden has gotten those states back, and with that, the White House.
So was it the virus versus the economy?
To some degree, yes, because we know that Trump voters tended to put a priority over opening up the economy over controlling the coronavirus. We know that Biden voters had the reverse priority. Their priority is, let's get the virus under control, as a higher priority than reopening the economy. So that was a divide. And the coronavirus, I think, reshaped this election in every possible way, from the issues that people cared about to the way people voted. That's only been since March that people have become fully aware of this virus. And yet it's had this huge impact and continues to have a huge impact. You know, it's reshaped the end of Trump's presidency. It will shape the beginning of Biden's presidency as well.
Vote counting will go on. It's not finished yet, but once Joe Biden hits that magic number of 270, it's over, no matter how many votes are still out there.
You know, we think the news media is very important, and we call these elections, but we don't actually officially have any role. It's just our interpretation of where things are going. Votes have to be certified by states, and then they choose electors, and the Electoral College meets on December 14th, and the Electoral College decides who's going to be president. But the purpose of these calls that we spend a lot of it time and effort making is to say, this is what we think will happen through that process. When the states certify the results, when the electors go to Washington for the Electoral College vote. This is important to keep in mind, because the news media doesn't determine this. The candidates do not determine it either. So say President Trump refuses to concede. It doesn't matter. It's not up to President Trump who gets elected. It's up to the Electoral College. And when they decide, if they decide Joe Biden is the next president, Joe Biden is the one who will be inaugurated on January 20th.
Of course, President Trump wanted to stop the voting at midnight on November 3rd. What did you make of that?
Well, I thought this was part of a strategy he had. You know, President Trump encouraged his voters to go to the polls on Election Day in the most traditional way, despite concerns about the coronavirus. And many of his voters did. Disproportionately, Republicans went to the polls on Election Day and cast their ballots. But Democrats were much more likely to cast mail-in ballots because of concern about COVID-19. That meant that if you cut off voting, if you cut off counting at midnight on Election Day, and if you had delayed the start of counting mail-in ballots, Democratic ballots wouldn't get counted and Republican ballots would. So I think that was the strategy reflected there. But to make it clear, this effort did not succeed. Ballots are being counted. It's taking longer than we've gotten used to in recent years, in recent elections. That process is going on. This election has actually run pretty smoothly.
Remarkably so.
And, you know, I think this idea of having a lot of people cast early ballots and cast mail-in ballots, I think people kind of like that, and that we're going to see more of that going forward, even if we don't have a pandemic to deal with.
It would certainly behoove those states, however, that do allow mail-in votes and early balloting to start counting those early on so as to avoid the kind of delay we're seeing in Pennsylvania.
Yes, I totally agree. It was a political decision by state legislatures like the one in Pennsylvania not to allow the ballot counting to begin. States that started processing their ballots a week ago were in much better shape by Election Day than a state like Pennsylvania and Michigan.
What did you make of Trump's remarks last evening?
You know, Diane, this is the sixth president I've covered, and I've just never heard anything like it. That one of the first things I ever covered in a campaign was Jimmy Carter's concession speech. I came in right at the end of that campaign. I covered George H.W. Bush's concession speech. So I've seen candidates lose, incumbent presidents lose, and it's hard. But I've never seen a candidate, and especially a president, cast aspersions on our democratic system and create doubt about whether it was something that voters could trust, that their trust to have votes counted fairly and accurately and only legal ballots counted. I thought it was extraordinary, and I thought it was distressing.
What happens then to this flurry of lawsuits that the president and Mike Pence are raising big bucks for?
Well, what has happened so far is that the courts are trying to deal with them very quickly, as they should, given that it's an ongoing process with a deadline ahead. But if these cases are without merit, which is what independent scholars say, courts are going to throw them out and they're not going to go anywhere. Now, sometimes things happen. President Trump says he wants this issue to go to the Supreme Court. You have to have a vehicle, a legitimate vehicle to get it there. Maybe that'll develop. At the moment, it doesn't look like it will develop. So it looks more like, at the moment at least, more like a delaying action or attempt to slow things down than a process that could seriously call into question the outcome of this election.
You wrote this week that even if Biden wins, it's not the big win that Democrats were hoping for.
You know, assuming Biden wins, it's going to be a big win for him. He'll receive more votes than anyone has ever received for president. He'll have a solid margin over his competitor. He'll have a majority of the popular vote. That's important. That's a big victory. But he didn't bring anybody with him. He is likely to have a Republican-controlled Senate. Do you think Mitch McConnell is going to be really cooperative in enacting a Biden agenda? I think that'll be tough. And a big surprise, Democrats lost ground in the House. Democrats and Republicans thought Democrats were going to gain seats in the House. They've lost seats 4 or 5. It's still being determined on some of these close races. So that means that while Biden has a big victory, he comes in without a Congress that's in a position to really deal with his big agenda. You know, this is historic. In fact, if you look back in history, the last Democratic president inaugurated without controlling both houses of Congress, you know when that was? I'll tell you, 1884.
Ah.
Because new presidents usually bring in control of Congress with them. That's been true of every new president since Bill Clinton. So Biden will have, he'll have a task to try to make it, to reach compromises with the Republican control, the Senate, which we assume will be under Republican control.
So why do you think this happened? Why do you think he lost ground in the House? Why couldn't he bring those people along with him?
I don't have a good answer for that. Now, in the House, Nancy Pelosi, the Speaker, this morning said that she thought that what happened was they had made gains. Democrats had made gains last time around in 2018, a big victory. They've gained 41 seats. They gained some Republican districts that they lost this time. That wouldn't be such a surprise. These Senate races, though, were a surprise. Both Democrats and Republicans thought that Democrats were likely to gain control of the Senate. They still could, but the only route to doing that now is to winning two special elections in Georgia, two runoff elections we expect to be held in January in Georgia. And that's an uphill task in that state.
So it's going to be pretty darn tough for Joe Biden to get a major piece of legislation through the Congress.
It's going to be a challenge. Now, that doesn't mean it's impossible. You know, there's some talk about resuming negotiations for a COVID-19 relief bill. You know, they've been talking about that since spring. They were unable to get a deal that both Democrats and Republicans in the White House would support. But one thing you've got to say on Biden's behalf, he's a creature of the Hill. You know, he was a longtime member of the Senate representing Delaware. He knows Mitch McConnell. He knows the people who are serving in the Senate and many of those in the House. He has a negotiating congressional kind of personality. He was often deployed by President Obama to go to the Hill when Obama needed deals made. So that will serve Biden well. But having a Republican Senate, well, it's just hard to overstate what kind of hurdles that could create.
And what happened in the Senate? You had your main senator, and I'm talking about M-A-I-N-E, win re-election when everybody thought she was going to lose.
So everybody outside Maine thought she was going to lose. People in Maine apparently disagreed. And this is one more reminder that we know so much less than we think we know. It's like a lesson I learn every time I cover a campaign, to not assume that I know what's going to happen, because all of us made the wrong assumption about whether Susan Collins would win yet another term.
A quick break. More of my conversation with Susan Page when we come back.
DCS Daily.
DCS Daily.
DCS Daily.
It's news,
culture, and curiosities.
From the District, Tacoma Park,
Alexandria,
Friendship Heights,
Hyattsville,
Falls Church,
Northeast Washington, D.C., in your inbox every weekday afternoon.
DCS Daily.
Sign up at dcs.com/newsletter.
dcs.com/newsletter.
Here's the rest of my conversation with Susan Page. She's USA Today Washington Bureau Chief and author of the forthcoming book, Madam Speaker, Nancy Pelosi, Lessons of Power. So what do you think we learned about the electorate overall?
One thing we learned is the durability of the Trump coalition. Because, you know, President Trump, it looks like he's lost his bid for a second term. That's a defeat. But he got 68 million votes. That's a lot of votes. 48% of the electorate, approximately. That's a higher percentage of the electorate than he won last time around. This despite all the questions about his handling of the coronavirus and the terrible cost to so many American families that meant. President Trump, people love him, people hate him. He has clearly tapped into something in the American electorate that we need to understand better as we go forward.
But is he going to be the one to teach us?
Well, I do not think that President Trump is going to go away quietly. And I don't mean by that that we'll have to like send in the armed forces to get him out of the White House. I don't think that's going to happen. But I think he is going to continue to try to be a voice that is heard, that hectors the new president, that has a big role in determining where the Republican Party stands. In fact, not impossible, of course, that he might run for another term in 2024. He could choose to do that.
That would be something. I must say, I sort of expect him to go back to making money because he does owe a fair amount of money.
But, you know, there are lots of ways to make money. And one way might be to become the Rush Limbaugh, the new Rush Limbaugh, for instance, you know, to start a TV network of your own that challenges Fox. I think you're right. I think making money has always been a priority for President Trump. Nothing wrong with that, but always been a priority for him. And I wouldn't expect that to change. Whether he'll have big legal problems and financial problems if when he leaves the White House, that'll be another factor. But I just don't, you know how we've seen modern presidents typically kind of remove themselves from the national debate?
George
W. Bush did and Barack Obama did. I don't really see Donald Trump following that model.
What do you think this election has indicated to folks around the world about the U.S.?
I think a lot of foreigners find it just flummoxing. Our system, our electoral college system, they did a big turn from Barack Obama to Donald Trump. I think that was confounding to a lot of them. And I think their vision of what the role the U.S. plays in the world has changed in the past 4 years and will continue to be changed. The United States has withdrawn from many of its alliances. It's weakened many of its alliances. It's moved to what President Trump calls America First. And even with a new president, that does not all change on a dime.
And I want to follow that up with your thoughts about the Electoral College. We did a podcast the other day with a scholar who believes that a constitutional amendment is not going to happen, but rather to somehow change the way the college operates, namely that within a given state, if the majority of the country votes one way, then the electors in each state would support that majority, rather than a state going with the majority of its own state votes. What's your thinking about that?
You know, the difficulty in making any adjustments in the Electoral College is the Electoral College benefits smaller states, right? And the problem, it reduces the power of big states like California, New York, and Texas. But to do anything like that, you need to get the states that now benefit from the system to agree to go along with changing the way it works. I just find that skeptical. As you know, I'm from Kansas. Kansas, I think, likes the Electoral College because it makes small states like Kansas and rural states like Kansas have more power than we would get under a popular vote system. So that's the trouble in thinking about changes in the Electoral College. One thing that two states have done so far, is to allocate their electors by congressional district. And that goes some distance to making it not the winner-take-all system. It has the effect of mixing things up a little bit and changing the impact of the Electoral College. If more states did that, that would be possibly an approach that deals with some of the inequities of the Electoral College without requiring states to give up this advantage they think they have under the system.
So you think not much is going to change?
I think it's hard. You don't want to ever say it's impossible. We've undertaken big changes in our country over many things. I just think the idea that that we're going to change the electoral college system is not something I'm holding my breath for.
Susan, what do you make of this whole election process that we've been through? This agony from Tuesday morning, and here we are Friday, and we don't yet have someone who has reached that 270 point, understanding your earlier point that the election won't be over even then. What do you make of what has happened here?
You know, Diane, I am not really distressed by the idea that it takes us a couple days to have the election, the results of the election be known. I think we should just be ready for that. That happens sometimes. But what concerns me a lot is the criticism that the system doesn't work, that it's rigged. That's what has happened this year with the president's allegations that I just think is so dangerous to a functioning democracy. And it's not something we usually think of as a problem for a mature democracy like the United States. It's something we think of as a problem for an emerging democracy that doesn't have the long experience that we do with elections. That's what worries me.
Do you think Trump will show up at the inauguration?
Wow, that's a hard bet. Well, let me ask you, what do you think?
I'm not sure. I'm really not sure. He could become the first president in modern history to say, I don't agree with this, and therefore I'm not going to go.
It's possible. He's challenged a lot of norms. I guess I assume at the end of the day he shows up, but I would not put money on it. What's of more concern, I think, is will his administration fully cooperate with the transition process so the new administration can take over kind of knowing what's going on, up to speed, able to act responsibly from the first hour and day that they're in power. That's of more concern. The law requires the outgoing administration to cooperate with the transition process. But, you know, cooperation can mean a lot of different things. And that's one thing that I think we need to watch closely.
But, Susan, it was my understanding that preliminary to the actual transition, there's already been a transition process underway with which the Trump group refused to participate.
Well, there's a federal law that requires the outgoing administration to participate in the transition process. And that's something that's been going on for some time. Since Biden emerged as the Democratic nominee and was nominated at the Democratic convention, that process began quietly. But there's cooperation and there's cooperation. You can cooperate fully and do everything you can to make things work for the new guy or not. I mean, how many of us have started new jobs with either a very friendly relationship or not such a friendly relationship with whoever was there before us? And they can be helpful or they can not be helpful. And I don't have a sense yet of whether the Trump administration officials are being cooperative when you think about agencies like Interior and Education and Homeland Security, not just the White House staff, but in all these agencies, this enormous federal bureaucracy that the Biden campaign, the Biden administration will take over, assuming he does win.
Susan, our listeners, I'm sure, would like to know what the experience was like for you as the moderator of the vice presidential debate.
So that was such a thrill to do. And I never expected to do it because Frank Fahrenkopf, again, a friend of the Diane Rehm Show, had once told me that it was too bad I could never moderate a debate because they only chose TV people. And in fact, I was the first print person to be a moderator, the solo moderator of a debate that the commission sponsored. So that was a great honor. And I was thrilled to do that. And the weirdest thing is, two things. One, I was not really nervous. And I worked hard. I worked on it.
Of course.
When the day came, I was not that nervous, which I attribute completely to my experience in guest hosting the Diane Rehm Show. Because I sat there on that stage with those two candidates, and it was like we were in the WAMU studio talking on the Diane Rehm Show for 90 minutes. And that was the experience that gave me the confidence to do that. So thank you, Diane Rehm.
Oh, I am so glad.
It's totally true. The second thing I would say is, I never saw the fly.
You never saw the fly.
We finished the debate. I walk backstage. All anyone is talking about is a fly. And I'm like, what fly?
Was there a point when you became frustrated that he would not stop talking?
I found that very frustrating. And I was glad in the next debate that they had muted the mics after 2 minutes and solved that problem, because he paid really no attention to my efforts to get him to stop talking. Now, Diane, you have long experience moderating. If you had been in that situation, what would you have done?
Well, a number of people have asked me that, and I said that if that had gone on that way, I probably would have gotten out of my chair as a way to signal that something was really, really going to have to change. But of course you couldn't do that. You couldn't do that. I kept saying there's got to be a mute to the mic, but then that would put the onus on you as the moderator. So I'm glad they put it in the hands of the engineers controlling those microphones.
Yes, I was a skeptic about the mute button, and I thought it worked great.
Me too. Susan, before we close, is there anything else you want to add about this election in general, Joe Biden or Donald Trump?
I think that that President-elect Biden is going to just face an enormous task. Now, I was trying to think about the last time a newly elected president had come into office at a moment when there were such serious problems facing the nation. And I went back to 1933 and FDR during the Depression, because even the financial meltdown that Obama had when he came in, or the Vietnam War protests that Richard Nixon faced when he came in, they don't really compare to the situation we have now, where more than 100,000 Americans are being diagnosed with COVID-19 every day.
Every day.
When hundreds of thousands of Americans have been killed by this disease, and when millions of Americans are out of work because of it, this is going to be an enormous task for the new president. I know we all wish Joe Biden well in facing it for all our sakes.
And anything about Donald Trump?
You know, I don't think Donald Trump created the disruptive, toxic situation that the country has found itself in. I think he recognized it and exploited it. So even when Donald Trump leaves the scene, these are factors that we're going to need to be thinking about how we got here and how we get out of it in a way that strengthens the country that I know we all love.
Susan, as always, thank you so much.
Diane, thank you.
That was Susan Page. She's Washington Bureau Chief of USA Today and author of the forthcoming book, Madam Speaker, Nancy Pelosi, Lessons of Power. And that's all for today. It's been a long week for all of us, and I thank you to those who've written in to let us know what you're thinking. You can find us on Facebook and Twitter. Send us an email, drpodcast@wamu.org. Our theme music is composed by Jim Brunberg and Ben Landsberg of Wonderly. The show is produced by Rebecca Kaufman and Allison Brody. Our engineer is Mike Kidd. Thanks for listening, all. Be patient, be calm, and wear those masks. I'm Diane Rehn.